loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Trump administration submitted a budget proposal today that would see massive cuts made to social programs, including Medicare, alongside a huge boost to military spending. Meanwhile, President Trump will unveil his infrastructure bill today. Critics say that it falls well short of what is needed to address the country's needs. Next, debate is set to begin in the Senate on a new immigration reform bill. Although no such debate has been scheduled in the House of Representatives, casting doubt on Republican protestations that they want immigration reform. Meanwhile, 120 immigrants detained in an ICE facility in Washington state have begun a hunger strike. And then Lisa Lucas was asked to testify before the West Virginia legislature on an oil and gas industry-sponsored bill that would allow companies to drill on private land without the owner's consent. A few minutes into her testimony, her microphone was turned off. And a few minutes after that, she was forcibly dragged out of the room. And then the Ohio Attorney General, a Republican, is suing DuPont and its spinoff, Chemours Company, for years of dumping toxic chemicals from its West Virginia plant into a river that fouled air, water, and land in neighboring Ohio, despite knowing the damage it was doing. And finally, the New York Times reported over the weekend that the U.S. intelligence community had recently conducted a top-secret operation to recover stolen classified documents from Russian operatives. The article says that the operation also inadvertently yielded a cache of documents related to Donald Trump and to Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The only problem is that the CIA, in a very rare public statement, says the report was, quote, fantasy and patently false, unquote. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the budget and infrastructure. The Trump administration today submitted a budget proposal that would see massive cuts made to social programs, including Medicare, alongside a huge boost to military spending. Meanwhile, President Trump will unveil his infrastructure bill today that critics say falls well short of what is needed to address the country's needs. We're joined from California by Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can read more of his writings at jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
So we're looking at this budget, which makes no sense in so many different ways. First of all, we've just gone through a massive tax cut and no corresponding budget cut. And now the president's talking about spending $1.5 trillion on infrastructure. Is it possible to pay for something like that without unprecedented cuts to social programs?
No, it isn't. Well, first of all, you got to remember that the contribution of the corporate and business tax cuts to the deficit and the debt is not $1.5 trillion. My estimates are that it's closer to $5 trillion. On my blog, I explain this, jackrasmus.com, because the $1.5 trillion assumption is ridiculous. It assumes a GDP growth on average for the next 10 years of between 3 and 4%. In other words, no recessions. Absurd assumptions about productivity and demographics, which are just the opposite of the long-term trend. So this $1.5 trillion is really a false number. It's going to be much larger, the tax cuts that were just passed. Now, on top of that, we've got this huge increase in defense spending, almost $200 billion net additional increase, and some increase in non-defense spending as part of this deal here with the Democrats, which pretty much the Democratic part is really extending CHIP, the children's insurance, and $90 billion, which is like 75% of the Democrats' spending for disaster relief. No, it's no real social program improvements. So what we really got is a budget deficit of last year of $666 billion that is going to double in 2019 to about $1.2 trillion, according to J.P. Morgan Chase. You know, not necessarily a radical source here. And look at $1 trillion deficits every year or more for at least the next 5 years or so. It's going to blow a huge hole in the deficit, according to Congressional Budget Office $10 trillion more to the deficit and debt over the next decade. That's probably an underestimate. They are going after Medicare. They are going after Medicaid. They, meaning Paul Ryan in the House, running the House, and Trump. They're going to make, in 2019, they're going to try to reduce that budget deficit and debt, that $10 trillion they're adding, mostly war spending and tax cuts, by going after social programs. And the only place they can go to get significant amount of cuts is Medicare, Medicaid, education, transportation, and the infrastructure bill will not pass, and it will be smoke and mirrors and another form of corporate subsidy, if you want to talk about that.
Tell us why these huge deficits are unsustainable. What's the end game here? I'm assuming it's because we're going to have to pay interest on all this money, and we're going to have to float longer and longer term bonds. The Chinese are going to buy more. Other investors are going to buy more, and we're going to have to pay them back for this money. Is that correct?
Well, the question is, will they buy that much more? Both the Japanese and the Chinese are already giving signals that they're not going to start. They're not going to buy as much of government debt as they had, let alone increase their purchase of government debt. What this means for everybody is that interest rates are going to rise, and they're already rising, and they're not rising very far, and they're already causing chaos in the stock and bond markets, particularly the bond markets. You raise interest rates on 10-year bonds to 3.5%. You know, it's like 2.8 now, and I've been predicting that 3.5% of the 10-year bond causes a credit crunch. In other words, in 2007, they raised rates to 5.5%, and that precipitated the crisis. Now they're moving, the central bank, the Fed's moving in the same direction, raising rates. And in my book, Central Bankers Into the Ropes, I say they cannot raise rates more than 3.5% before creating this crisis, but they are going to have to raise rates if they want to deal with getting enough funds to fill part of this massive deficit debt hole. They're caught between a rock and a hard place. Raise the 3.5% to cover the deficit and debt, or 3.5%, and you're going to get another crisis.
I think those who were, you know, the architects of Trump's tax plan aren't really concerned about the deficit at all. I think for them, they're like, okay, we can sort of loot the national treasury or redistribute wealth from the bottom to the top. Good. We take the money. We take additional money. We get this huge windfall. And then ultimately, if there's a big deficit, one of two things happens. It gets reduced as a consequence of cutting social programs, which benefit poor and working class people, which they don't care about. They'd prefer to cut them. Or two, it creates a recession or an economic contraction, which may also be, in some circumstances, and certainly is under certain circumstances, beneficial to the biggest corporate barons and the biggest bankers, because again, they're not going to lose their money. They're not going to lose their homes for the most part. They're not going to go to jail. They're going to be too big to jail. But again, it has the effect of creating a larger reserve army of the unemployed. It puts downward pressure on wages. Ultimately, that's kind of good for business. What do you think, Jack?
Well, yeah, that's good for a certain section of business whose profits depend on wages, and that's a significant grouping. But, you know, we got a financialized economy. We have a new global finance capital elite running the show. They're running the Trump government economic policy. I mean, Goldman Sachs is running the Treasury. Cohn is running a policy within the White House. And you've got in the Fed now, they're going to stack the Fed with these investment bankers. So finance, you have a collapse of profits on the financial side. You can already see the big, dress rehearsal of last week of these stock prices. The stock collapse is directly related to the bond prices, bond yields, rates rising. So if the bond yields rise much more, you're going to have a bigger collapse in the stock market, and that's going to cause all kind of problems in the credit system.
Jack, let me jump in. Because most people, unless you're an investor, they don't know what some of these terms mean. And frankly, sometimes their eyes glaze over. So just in layperson's language, explain to our audience how the bond market impacts and has impacted on stock prices and on the volatility of the stock market. We have about 90 seconds left. Go ahead.
Okay. When bond yields, interest rates rise as fast as they have been and as high as they have been, then money that has been flowing into stock markets, equity markets, and other derivative markets flows out of those markets. So if the money flows out, the prices collapse in those markets. The prices of stocks and derivatives and exchange and so forth will collapse. When the prices of financial assets collapse, credit dries up. And if it dries up, then corporations that aren't financial have to cut back on their spending and in their employment and so forth. So that's the thread by which escalating bond yields impact the real economy. And that's exactly what happened back in 2007 and 8. The bond market is far more important than the stock market. It's like, you know, magnitudes larger. And when you have a crisis in the bond market, including junk bonds, then it impacts other financial markets, and raising the rates on interest on the Fed, 3.5%, I predict, is going to precipitate this big financial contraction that's coming, and that will spill over, as it did in 2008, to the real economy and cause a big contraction in the real economy. That's the dilemma they're facing.
We are going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, Jack. That was the voice of Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can read more of his writings at jackrasmus.com. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Debate is set to begin in the Senate on a new immigration reform bill today, although no such debate has yet been scheduled in the House of Representatives, casting doubt on Republican protestations that they want immigration reform. Meanwhile, 120 immigrants detained in an ICE facility in Washington state have begun a hunger strike. We're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barón. He is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Jorge, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Jorge, there was a terrific article today in the Washington Post, a similar one in the New York Times, saying that this new immigration bill on the Senate side is so unusual because it's actually not even really a bill yet. It's a skeleton of a bill. It's empty, devoid of any even real language, with the idea being that anybody and everybody in the U.S. Senate can offer amendments, so that the amendments actually become a part of the bill, with the idea being that enough people will be vested in it that it'll get the 60 votes necessary for passage. It's actually quite an enlightened idea. On the House side, though, literally nothing is happening. And Paul Ryan has not said that he will even allow debate to begin, even if the Senate passes this amendment-laden bill by 60 votes and sends it to the House. What do you think is going on here in Washington?
Well, I think it's hard to know what's happening in Washington, but it is concerning. I mean, so on the one hand, you know, obviously we do want there to be a debate on this issue. I mean, it's overdue, but I am concerned that what is going to happen is a repeat of what happened in 2013, when there was a fairly robust debate in the Senate, and there was a bill passed by a strong bipartisan margin. 68 senators voted in favor of that bill. And then, you know, nothing happened in the House, and we ended up with nothing.
Yeah.
And so I think there's precedent for this having occurred, and I think whatever gets through the Senate should get a hearing in the House. But right now, that doesn't seem to be the path that the Speaker is going.
You know, I remember back in 2001, there was an agreement between the governments of the United States and Mexico to allow for a new kind of system of work visas, where pretty much anybody who wanted to come across the border to work could do so on this temporary work visa, so long as they paid taxes and kept Mexico or whatever their home country happened to be as their actual domicile. So they would come here for 9 months out of the year, work, pay taxes, go home, and then come back again 3 months later. That fell apart because of the 9/11 attacks. And every couple of years, politicians on both sides of the aisle say, you know, that was a really great idea. It ought to be a starting point. Do we have a starting point for this Senate bill yet, or are we starting from scratch?
Well, I think the problem is that right now, the way that the debate has been framed is around the DACA situation. And this is the problem is that what I'm concerned a little bit about is that the president has basically created a crisis. And then he's trying to take advantage of this crisis. And he's created the crisis by ending the DACA program, right, which has been a fairly successful, even if it's a temporary, you know, fix to a specific problem in our immigration system. And so he's now trying to use the crisis that he developed to try to push through what, you know, many of us view as a white supremacist vision of immigration policy. And so I think the problem is that I think there's a definite debate that needs to happen about a broader immigration reform bill. But what we would prefer is for us to deal with the crisis that the president created by passing a legislation that has been introduced in Congress since 2001, that has been vetted, that has been discussed for many years, which is the DREAM Act. We can accomplish that piece and then focus on the broader issues about immigration reform in an environment where we're not sort of having the president sort of hanging the fate of you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are very connected to our communities now as essentially hostages, so that we can get an immigration reform that is consistent with his views. I think that's what concerns me about the way that the debate is sort of being framed right now.
And that's something that I think our listeners need to remember too, is this is a made up crisis. Donald Trump made this a crisis. There wasn't a problem with DACA until he decided he wasn't going to respect it and he wasn't going to abide by it any longer. And I'll tell you another thing too. Today's Washington Post said that another made up crisis now is Immigration and Customs Enforcement raiding people's homes, people who have lived in the United States for many years, in some cases decades. Many of them are business owners. They have families. Their children are American citizens. They have never been in trouble with the law, ever. But they're being rounded up now, too, just because ICE is under pressure to meet Donald Trump's numbers of people to be arrested and expelled.
Absolutely. And that's what we're seeing on the ground level. And one of the things that certainly concerns us about the fact that the administration has, as the ICE acting director has said, you know, lifted any kind of restraints. I think he put it as, you know, taking the handcuffs off of ICE. And, you know, we would say that it was not handcuffs. It was just, you know, reasonable priorities about enforcement. But the Trump administration has said, you know, go after everybody. And this is having, you know, profound impact on local communities and leading to people who've had long ties to the community being torn apart from their families and their workplaces. And, you know, I will say that there's been a lot of pushback at the local level. But one of the things that concerns us is that, you know, under the other administrations where when this would happen, you know, ICE may use prosecutorial discretion and decide, you know what, maybe this is right. Maybe we shouldn't go after this person. But right now, they seem to be immune to some of the pressure that communities have brought to bear when there's these kind of enforcement actions.
We're speaking from Seattle with Jorge Barón. He's the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Jorge, tell us, give us an idea of a timeline. When do you think it will be that we will know one way or the other if we're going to have a deal or we're not going to have a deal? Do we need to wait until the Senate actually passes something and refers it to the House, or do you think we'll have an inkling before that?
Well, I think we're going to have a couple of key deadlines. I think we'll have the next 2 weeks, which is when Senator McConnell has said that he will open up the Senate floor for this debate. And so I think 2 weeks from now, we'll know what the outcome was in the Senate, and we'll either have a bill that has gathered, you know, what I would expect to be bipartisan support, obviously, because that's the only way you're going to get something out of the Senate or not. And so, you know, if we can't get anything out of the Senate, then I think we're pretty stuck on this debate.
Yeah.
But even if we accomplish that, which is an if, then the question will move to the House. And I think that I suspect that by late March, we will know whether anything is going to be moving forward in the House, because after March, I suspect that we're going to start getting into campaign mode for the upcoming elections. And I would be doubtful that we're going to see legislation moving. So I think the next 6-7 weeks are going to be really critical, and why we hope people are going to be engaged in letting their representatives know what kind of reform they want to the immigration system. And again, we hope that it will be something that will be, at this stage, not following on the president's made-up crisis and to try to take advantage and propose radical reforms that are going to undermine one of the core pieces of our immigration policy, which has been family reunification.
It's not only a made-up crisis. The whole atmosphere of hostility and animus towards immigrants is also made up. This has been going on. It's been going on for a long time, but Trump has really exacerbated this. He made Mexicans and immigrants the punching bag for 2016.
Oh, yeah.
There was that other story, the customs officer in Texas who died. And Trump, his name was Martinez, and Trump wrote a tweet back in November 19th. Border Patrol officer killed at southern border, another badly hurt. We will seek out and bring to justice those responsible. We will and must build the wall. In other words, making it clear that he thinks and he wants the world to know and the country to know Mexicans or Mexico killed this officer. Well, it turns out now the studies are in. It appears that the officer fell.
Mm-hmm. He fell and hit his head.
He fell and hit his head, as did another officer. It's a tragic event. But nonetheless, it's not just a knee-jerk reaction. Trump has been looking for every piece of evidence, including made-up things, to create an atmosphere of extreme hostility, racism, animus towards immigrants. And that's what makes passing a bill, quote, complicated in the Congress. It's because an artificial and racist atmosphere has been created by a lot of politicians, first and foremost among them, Donald Trump. Go ahead. We have 1 minute left.
No, I completely agree with that. And that's what concerns us about having a debate at this moment, is that the situation has been created by the president of using these, dog whistle messages to a lot of people about the dangers of the gang members and the people coming from countries. And so this messages of, brown and black people coming to harm you. And that in that kind of environment, having a rational debate about immigration policy is very difficult. And while I don't want him to set the terms of debate, I am concerned that in this environment we may end up with some of the politicians responding to that to those messages and those ideas.
We agree with you. We agree with you. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barron. He's the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Lisa Lucas was asked to testify before the West Virginia legislature on an oil and gas industry-sponsored bill that would allow companies to drill on private land without the owner's consent. A few minutes into her testimony, her microphone was turned off. And a few minutes after that, she was forcibly dragged out of the room. We're joined from Huntington, West Virginia by Natalie Thompson. She is the executive director of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. Natalie, welcome.
Thank you.
Natalie, you were actually in the room when this happened. Is that correct?
Yes, we were all preparing to testify for the public hearing on the co-tenancy legislation that the West Virginia House of Delegates is proposing.
You know, when I first saw this headline over the weekend, I thought, well, there has to be something more to it than this woman just forcibly dragged out of the legislative committee room. She must have said something. She must have done something. But she didn't. She didn't do anything to
deserve
this.
You mean like she must have been cursing?
Right.
Or
she must have been cursing them. She must have violated some kind of, you know, decorum or standards or something. But she did nothing of the sort. She was just talking about the oil and gas companies that had donated money, political money, to the members of this committee. Is that right?
Yeah, she was reporting on campaign contributions, contributions to their campaign from oil and gas industry lobbyists and companies. And that's all public information. So actually, I felt that she was her right to speech was being violated by her not being allowed to discuss that. And in fact, the chairman of the committee said that she was speaking of personal comments about the committee. And last time I checked, campaign finance contributions do not have anything to do with your personal life.
You get to vote, John, every 2 or 4 years for politicians, but you can't publicly in an open hearing say who they're getting their campaign contributions for. Because if you do, at least in this part of the country and maybe in other parts of the country, they'll just drag you off the podium.
Well, Mark Twain once said that if voting mattered, they wouldn't let us do it in the first place.
Lisa Lucas traveled, Natalie, 100 miles from her home to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. And I'm looking at an article that's up on Common Dreams. It's written by Russell Muckabar, and I'll read a couple sentences to it from it and ask you to respond. Lucas took to the podium and began by pointing out that, quote, the people who are going to be speaking in favor of this bill are all going to be paid by the industry. And the people who are going to be voting on this bill are often also paid by the industry. I have to keep this short because the public only gets a minute and 45 seconds while lobbyists can throw a gala at the Marriott with whiskey and wine and talk for hours to the delegates. So then she started naming the elected officials who are actually getting contributions from the corporations. And what happened next, Natalie?
The chairman asked her to discontinue making personal comments about the committee members.
This public information they consider to be personal comments.
Yeah, correct.
But I want for our audience here in Washington to really understand. They said you can't make personal comments when she was talking about the money they got from corporations. What actually happened next? What took place?
They had two persons who act as security on the floor there. One came up and tapped her on the shoulder and, you know, told her that she needed to leave. The chairman said, you know, you need to get her out of here, basically. The other one came over, pulled the microphone away from her, and she continued and said, I want to finish. And they said, no. And she said, well, then drag me out then. And so as they were taking her out of the chambers, she was still, you know, saying that basically that she had a right to discuss it, and that if they consider that personal, then she is sorry that this is what it came to in our state of West Virginia politics.
Yeah, of course she has the right to do it. I mean, the people who dragged her out or cut off her microphone, you know, there's a phrase going around, who's meddling in our democracy? Well, I'd say it's these corporations and the politicians who act like they're servants who are meddling in our democracy.
Well, let's talk about that, because the bill that she was going to testify about is so anti-democratic that I can't believe it's even being considered. Natalie, tell us about this bill. This would allow oil companies to come and drill on your private land without your permission. How in the world is that legal or constitutional?
Well, there could be, you know, constitutional issues with that. However, there's a lot of other states that have co-tenancy legislation and have been able to get away with it. So the way that this bill came out of the Energy Committee spoke as such that if within a tract of land, if 75% of the owners had consented to the drilling to happen, that the other 25% that were non-consenting owners would be forced into the same tract, so that the drilling well pad, which consumes about 15 acres of land, by the way, would be able to be placed on that surface owner's property that have not consented to the drilling process. The bill has since changed, when it went back into committee. It has changed as of now with further provisions for the surface owners and better provisions on royalties and bonuses with the 25% non-consenting or unknown owner, you know, being kind of forced into the drilling process. However, fundamentally, it's not democratic for someone's, you know, surface owners or mineral owners or whatever type of an ownership that you have of your land to be used in ways that you do not want it to be used.
Natalie, tell our listeners also about this term surface owners. So in West Virginia, if you own land, does that mean you only own the surface of the land? You don't necessarily own the minerals that are underground?
Right. So in like the mid to late 1870s, somewhere around there. However, a lot of the minerals were sold for mining purposes, for coal mining that we're so famous for, and persons still kept their surface owner's rights, but they may not have the rights to the minerals beneath the surface of their land.
Incredible.
That belongs to the mining corporations, or the oil belongs to ExxonMobil, or, I mean, it really shows the tortured nature of democracy when the rights that people have or think they have are so limited, especially if they come into conflict at all with those who are sort of the dominant forces within a corporate-based economy. In other words, they actually go to the front of the line. And I think there's no question that this is unconstitutional.
It's
unconstitutional in many, many ways. The fact that some states have allowed unconstitutional practices to be upheld in state law and state courts doesn't mean that it's actually constitutional. I mean, this is a flagrant violation.
Right. Well, the argument is that 75% of the owners who are consenting and do want to file leases to have the minerals extracted from their land are not able to do what they wish with their land. So it's a catch-22 situation there.
Yeah, it really is. You know, this is probably neither here nor there, but one of the things that fascinates me about situations just like this is how in the world is it that West Virginia has become a Republican state? If it's the Republicans that are advocating this deregulation, if it's the Republicans who are actively supportive of the mining industries and vice versa, then what about the little guy? Why is the little guy then lining up to vote against his or her own best interests by supporting a political party or a candidate that advocates taking away their individual rights and liberties? It's a mystery to me. I just don't know how it happened.
Yeah, well, we have a long history of being dependent on industry for our well-being, you know, from an economical perspective. And then we've also had, you know, a long history of being oppressed by industry. So when people are desperate and poor to put food on the table, they're looking for the next way out. They're not looking for what their rights are or how their lives are being compromised. They can't even make it that far because they're so worried about just how they're going to get through the day and onto the next day and taking care of their families. You know, industry here has treated our people, you know, basically to which you have, you know, indentured servitude almost. I mean, back in the early coal mining days, you were paid in coal mine script and had to shop at the general coal mine store so that even the money that you earn went back to the company for your well-being and for the health and prosperity for your family. And so it's just a long time of the little guy having to, you know, just give everything that he has in order to take care of himself and his family.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course it's the Democrats and the Republicans who are tied to the corporate entities.
Right. That's right, both parties.
You know, I want to thank you, Natalie, for your comments. I think it's good to put it into perspective that people in such dire circumstances, the corporations can sort of play them against each other as they are doing, obviously, with some private property owners. If people are desperate enough and must, of course, feed their families, then they're manipulatable by these same corporate entities. But that's why it's so important that what you're doing, what the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition is doing, what Lisa Lucas did, even though she was dragged out. We want to take our hats off to you and thank you for your amazing work.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Huntington, West Virginia by Natalie Thompson. Natalie is the executive director of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Ohio Attorney General is suing DuPont and its spinoff Chemours Company for years of dumping toxic chemicals from its West Virginia plant into a river that fouled air, water, and land in neighboring Ohio, despite knowing the damage it was doing. We're joined from Huntington, West Virginia by Robin Blakeman. She is the Huntington Project Coordinator with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Robin, I'm looking at a couple of news reports about this dumping, and this is very serious dumping. It's a highly toxic chemical that causes a variety of cancers. And as it turns out, the citizens of both West Virginia and Ohio who live near the river that's been polluted are all testing with elevated levels of this chemical. How long has this been going on?
More than a decade, I believe. It's been a long time. The problem has been that a lot of water systems have had lower standards for this chemical and not labeled it a problem until recently when the EPA set some different standards and they had to go back, such as what happened at Vienna, West Virginia in 2016.
What can you tell us about environmental protection standards or environmental protection efforts in your area? Have things gotten better or have they gotten worse over the years?
Well, I would say generally, in terms of the last 5 to 10 years, things have gone steadily downhill.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, there's been a definite trend towards deregulation for fossil fuel industries, chemical industries, et cetera. In terms of regulation, there's been a relaxing or lax enforcement of the regulations we already have on the books, and we are now concerned by RSANCO, the Ohio River Sanitation Commission's efforts to abdicate their role in pollution control setting standards for the Ohio River.
What are governments in the region doing besides this lawsuit being filed by Mike DeWine, the Attorney General of Ohio? Are there any other measures that local governments are taking to try to get the chemical companies to stop dumping like this?
Not a lot. Actually, this lawsuit from the Ohio Attorney General is kind of a surprise to us in this region. We're glad that they're looking into that, but other officials seem to take it as business as usual that there will be pollution in, you know, our tap water source, which is the Ohio River, for 3 to 5 million people in this region, which is kind of sad, but it is unfortunately kind of the way they do regular operating procedures. If you look at information related to the Vienna issues, which again cropped up in 2016 when they had to provide jugs and bottled water for all the citizens of this small town of Vienna, a town of about 10,000, you'll see some quotes from Vienna mayor at the time, Randy Rapp, and you know he blames the EPA for the lowering the standards and, you know, causing most of the problem rather than the corporation who actually polluted the tap water with millions of gallons of sludge, the C8 sludge. So
disgusting.
It is very sad, but that's often the way things go around here.
You know, John, the big mantra by politicians when they're trying to appeal for corporate campaign funds or banking campaign funds is that we have to get rid of regulations,
right?
Because that's why business isn't thriving the way it could be thriving. And people just sort of accept it. It becomes like a meaningless, abstract cliche
I've been struck at how successful Republicans and conservatives have been in painting regulation as a bad thing that needs to be done away with.
Yeah, sort of like central planners, bureaucratic domination, the wonderful free marketeers inhibited. Otherwise, we'd all have great paying jobs and everything would be perfect. I want to read from Bloomberg News. A 2017 study found that residents of the area have elevated levels of the chemical. I can't pronounce the chemical. It's PFOA, I believe.
Yes.
If elevated levels of the chemical in their blood, according to the suit, which also cites health studies done on the thousands of personal injury plaintiffs that sued DuPont around this site. The studies found that the chemical had probable links to diseases including kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis, and high cholesterol. Quote, and this is from the lawsuit, DuPont intentionally concealed the dangers of PFOA, that's the chemical, from government entities and the public at large in order to protect its profits and avoid public responsibility for injuries. Now, Robin and John, if I was to take, you know, a chemical weapon and I was going to spray that chemical weapon around these parts of Ohio or West Virginia, and the result was that people were either seriously injured or diseased or in some cases killed, I would be accused of using a weapon of mass destruction against a civilian population.
That's right.
And I would certainly go to prison.
Without any doubt.
Minimally.
Yes.
But if you're a corporation and you willfully, intentionally conceal from the government the use and the dumping of a chemical into the water and into the ground soil that's doing just that, having the same impact on people, on human beings, then the most you might lose is a civil liability, or maybe your stocks will go down as Chemours have gone down a little bit, maybe 3%. But it's not real justice. I mean, what people are dealing with, the outrage of what people are dealing with, that's the thing that we have to sort of make available to the public, because it seems to me, and I don't know why Mike DeWine, he's a politician, he's a Republican politician, former yes. U.S. Senator, now Attorney General, why he filed the lawsuit. I think it's a good thing he did it, whatever his motives are. But we actually have to create a mass movement around this. Go ahead, Robin.
Oh, I totally agree with you. And that's the comparison that we've made often, is that, you know, it's chemical weaponry that's happening in a lot of our communities. And it's not just this C8 issues. There's issues with toxic coal sludge in our communities, legacy coal waste that are causing high levels of mercury to be dumped into the Ohio River, and now oil and gas industries that are polluting our waterways and air.
You know, there's another part of this story that's infuriating to me. It's covered in the Bloomberg article that you cited, Brian, as well as a couple of small local law journals. But it says, although Chemours agreed to cover DuPont for liability linked to the chemical when it was spun off, a more recent agreement would have them share liabilities from claims at the site, and Chemours has refused to accept liability for punitive damages. So that tells me that they knew from the beginning that this chemical was poison and that it's making its way into the environment and that it's poisoning people. But they're fighting internally about who's going to pay for it.
Yeah, and also the issue of punitive damage. In a civil lawsuit, people don't go to jail. But that's what punitive damages are for. Punitive damages aren't just compensation for lost wages or to cover medical bills. Punitive damage is a fix to the party that has inflicted harm, either through neglect or intentionally, which of course is what's happened here. It's both intentional and neglectful. But if you don't have punitive damages, then what these corporations and companies do is just number crunching.
Mm-hmm.
They think, okay, we're gonna pay so much XYZ. We're not gonna have real punitive damages potentially, and as a consequence, it's actually cheaper for us to poison the people and then face some lawsuits and pay a civil fine.
You know, we saw that many years ago with the Ford Motor Company, where Pintos began exploding when they were hit from behind, and Ford accidentally released an internal memo to a congressional investigating committee, which showed that they had made a determination that it was cheaper for them just to allow people to continue dying in these explosions and to pay settlements to those who were killed, to the families of those who were killed, than it was to actually repair the mistake that was causing the explosions in the first place. We see this with chemical companies all the time.
Yeah.
It's cheaper for them just to pay the fine and to keep poisoning the environment than it is to actually change the way they do business.
And the board of directors are going to go home to their very fancy houses in environments that are not affected by this kind of toxic dumping. Robin Blakeman is our guest. She is the Huntington Project Coordinator with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. We have about 90 seconds, Robin. Talk about your organization and what people in your community or in your area are doing, what they can do to do something about this absolutely grievous, outrageous poisoning of the people by corporations. Go ahead.
Well, OVEC is a nonprofit grassroots organizing group that's been around for 30 years in the Huntington and West Virginia area primarily. We are a nonprofit, as I said, and could use some more members to kind of show a lot of concern in these realms. As I said, the C8 issue is only one of many in our state and region that reflect the same issues that you've talked about throughout this interview. We have a multitude of them.
And what's your website real quick?
www.ohdec.org.
ohdec.org. Okay, I think we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined by Robin Blakeman. She is the Huntington Project Coordinator with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The New York Times reported over the weekend that the U.S. intelligence agencies conducted a top-secret operation recently to recover stolen classified documents from Russian operatives. The article said that the operation also inadvertently yielded a cache of documents related to Donald Trump and to Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The only problem is that the CIA, in a very rare public statement, says that the report is, quote, fantasy, close quote, and, quote, patently false, close quote. John Kiriakou, I mean, we talked earlier today when we were thinking about how to do this story. We thought, wow, what a bizarre story. A really bizarre story. We want to walk people through what the story is. But let's start with the CIA's denial, because the denial also is rare, and I want people to actually hear what they said.
Yeah, the denial is very, very rare. The CIA traditionally has no comment whatsoever on news media reports related to the agency, related to operations, related to sources and methods. This was a very unusual denial, and it was also further unusual because it was so categorical. You and I were talking about this off the air, and we think we've figured it out. We think that the CIA waited to issue a denial until the story got out there into the press, and then issued this categorical denial just to embarrass the authors of the piece. Now, the authors were James Risen, formerly of the New York Times, and Matt Rosenberg of the New York Times.
So the New York Times broke the story.
That's right.
And Rosenberg was the author of the story. And in the story, where the story was that the CIA had been bilked out of $100,000 by a Russian operative who was going to return the cyber weapons that had been stolen from the NSA and also had, quote, dirt on Donald Trump. That was, right, in essence, what the story said, right?
Yes.
So Matt Rosenberg wrote the story. And as you mentioned, Rosenberg called the CIA for comment, and the CIA declined to comment.
Right.
Then the New York Times went ahead and published the story. The Intercept, James Risen, former New York Times, now working for The Intercept, he published a like story, a similar story, and then the CIA issued a comment. So they waited.
They did. They waited on purpose. Now, the CIA has a very long and ugly history with James Risen. James Risen is a legendary reporter. Two Pulitzer Prizes, innumerable books on the New York Times bestsellers list. And in fact, over the years when he was at the New York Times, if he developed intelligence information that was so sensitive that the New York Times refused to run it, usually at the request of the White House or the CIA director, he would write it in a book. And famously wrote a book called Bush at War in the early or the mid 2000s. I think it was 2006 it came out. That led to the prosecution of Jeffrey Sterling, a CIA officer who many of us believe was innocent of passing this information to Risen. But anyway, the point
and
is
Jeffrey Sterling just got out of halfway house today.
Today, just wow. in the last couple of
been
hours.
In prison.
He's been in prison, yeah, for 2.5 years. And just got out of a halfway house today, thank goodness. But I think that the CIA set out to embarrass Risen because Risen has embarrassed them so many times. Now, with that said, if you look at the details of these articles, the article in the New York Times and the follow-up article in The Intercept, the information doesn't make any sense. This is not the way an intelligence operation is carried out. This is not the way a CIA officer would go about collecting information. You don't just walk around with $100,000 in cash and offer it up to a Russian operative and then just hope that he provides you with the information that you're seeking. That's just not how it's done in real life. Risen knows that. Risen's sources are excellent. He has sources all through the intelligence community. And Matt Rosenberg is a national security correspondent. He knows better than that. I have to wonder why both Rosenberg and Risen and these two respected outlets, the New York Times and The Intercept, would publish something that's just so weak on the facts.
The statement, the denial by the CIA reads, the fictional story that that CIA was bilked out of $100,000 is patently false. This is a statement the CIA issued and sent to AFP, French news agency. Quote, the people swindled here were James Risen and Matt Rosenberg. That's, again, the CIA. They're saying you were swindled.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they did not comment when Rosenberg called them to get their comment on the story before it was published. But it's also interesting that this weird, bizarre story that you said as a former CIA officer when you were hearing it, it just sounded too bizarre, which doesn't mean things stranger than fiction don't happen.
Oh, sure,
but,
sure.
But it seemed bizarre to you. Nonetheless, Donald Trump also got in on the act because according to the Times, the Russian operative, the shadowy figure who bilked the CIA out of $100,000 offering to return cyber weapons that in fact were never returned, he also said, we have dirt on Donald Trump, and the intelligence agency, the CIA, said, well, we're not interested in that. But then Donald Trump has spent the weekend tweeting and saying, this story proves that the CIA was out, in fact, to get Donald Trump.
Right, so deep state.
So we have a double whammy, triple whammy thing going on here because the original story, according to the Times, according to the CIA, not true, which doesn't mean they're telling the truth.
Sure.
Because it's the CIA.
Right.
But you have Donald Trump who made a big story out of what appears to be a non-story. If he's going to believe his own CIA, and I guess he sort of kind of has to believe his own CIA, it's led by Mike Pompeo. Pompeo would have to be standing behind the statement, wouldn't he?
He would have to be. You know, this is one of the funny things about Donald Trump and his relationship with the CIA. It's as though there are two CIAs in his mind. There's the Mike Pompeo, Gina Haspel CIA, which loves Donald Trump and who Donald Trump loves. And then there's the rest of the CIA that Donald Trump thinks is part of the deep state that's trying to unseat him as president. I'm not sure how he reconciles the two in his own mind, but if you believe his tweets, he certainly believes that there are different forces at work here.
Well, the CIA has denied it, but when I'm looking at the Times so far, again, we're Monday afternoon, we're recording mid-afternoon. As of right now, the New York Times hasn't taken down the story, I don't believe.
Neither has The Intercept.
And The Intercept hasn't either, and there's no correction. So obviously both media outlets will be now having to do another story and to deny or to confirm their own original story. In a way, because if they vested this much in the story and the story turns out to be flagrantly untrue— and again, the CIA normally never denies or confirms a story,
but now
they're going out and saying, no, actually, this is false. This story isn't going to actually end now. It now takes us into a new turn.
That's right.
How did the story happen? Why did it happen? Was it politically motivated? who's the beneficiary? It appeared that over the weekend that Donald Trump was the beneficiary because he could claim victimhood once again.
That's right.
Anyway, it's going to get, I don't know, we're going to go into another few bizarre twists and turns here.
Yeah, I think that Donald Trump's statement and the CIA's statement over the weekend is going to force the hand now of the New York Times and The Intercept. They're going to have to either back off the story and say so in print, or they're going to have to double down and give the public more details from whoever their source happens
because
to be.
Because the sources were, again, anonymous sources. I want to read a couple sentences from the original story just for people to grasp the how the Times actually felt they were onto something big here. After months of, this is the opening sentence, after months of secret negotiations, a shadowy Russian bilked American spies out of $100,000 last year, promising to deliver stolen National Security Agency cyber weapons in a deal that he insisted would also include compromising material on President Trump, according to American and European intelligence officials. The cash delivered in a suitcase. Now, remember, the CIA saying none of this happened. Or at least they're saying the story is not true. Maybe
right.
There's something that's true, but the story is
it's
wrong.
Possible. Sure.
The cash delivered in a suitcase to a Berlin hotel room in September was intended as the first installment of a $1 million payout, according to American officials, the Russian and communications reviewed by the New York Times. The theft of the secret hacking tools had been devastating to the NSA, and the agency was struggling to get a full inventory of what was missing. Now, that part of the story is true.
Yes. We know that from Ed Snowden.
Yeah. And the NSA has been developing cyber weapons to be able to exploit vulnerabilities rather than to patch or repair vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet they lost control of their own cyber weapons. They're now out there. And once they're out there, they're available to everybody.
That's it. They're gone for good.
So it should be called the National Insecurity Agency because they made everybody less secure. But yes, that part of the story would be true. The NSA would undoubtedly want more information, it would seem to me, as a layperson, about this thing. So if that was part of it, you could see how dangling something like that might be, you know, very, very interesting to intelligence agents. Except, again, the CIA is saying didn't happen.
Well, and let's talk about that, too. In the event that this played out the way the Times and The Intercept say it did, let's say there was such a meeting in a hotel in Berlin. What would happen in real life is the source of the information, the Russian, let's say that there really was a Russian operative. The Russian would be asked to meet, in this case, in a hotel. And a CIA officer or multiple CIA officers would go to meet with this person who would be treated as a walk-in. This is a volunteer, an unvetted volunteer. And so they would meet with this person. They would get an idea of the information that he has and wants to peddle. They would look at it, make copies of it, take pictures of it, whatever it is that they felt they needed to do, or take samples of it, physically take the samples. And they would send that intelligence, that information, back to CIA headquarters and to NSA to vet it and to see if it really is intelligence. Now, if it was intelligence and it was something that the CIA was interested in recouping, they would set up a follow-up meeting and they would bring probably not 100,000. They would probably bring the whole million if they had agreed to pay $1 million for it. But this, you know, $100,000 in what comes down to an earnest money deposit is just not the way things are done in real life.
So we know it's spy against spy. Now maybe it's spy against national security reporter. It sort of seems like it could be both. We just don't know. We're going to keep following the story. We're completely out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com or subscribe to Loud and Clear at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.